Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode 349, almost to that 350 mark. Pretty outstanding. If you're listening to this on June 17th, 2018, then happy Father's Day. I hope all of you out there were able to celebrate some sort of Father's Day, or you had something to do, or maybe you just sat back and relaxed. In the news, just wanted to give a huge shout out again to all the people out there, the brothers who have been supporting this program. It is very much appreciated, and it makes it so that we can bring this show to you week after week uninterrupted and actually keep all of the episodes from the beginning, number one, all the way to this episode 349 up on the web so that we can continue to bring Masonic education out to the masses. Our previous episodes are not deleted or archived anywhere. We do have an issue, of course, with iTunes. iTunes only shows, I guess, like 200 episodes or something. So if you are looking for the first few episodes, the best place to get those is really just through our website, or you can go over to our Liberated Syndication RSS feed. You can listen to them there or on our Liberated Syndication website. But all the links are just on our site, wcypodcast.com. Feel free to click around and explore. There's some great things for you there. The first piece I have for you this week is called Freemasonry and the Hermetic Tradition. Freemasonry and the Hermetic Tradition by R.A. Gilbert from Gnosis Number 6. If, as is stated categorically by the United Grand Lodge of England, Freemasonry is not a secret society and is, quote-unquote, not a religion or a substitute for religion, then what is it? And why should students of the occult be concerned with the history, symbolism, and rituals of this peculiar system of morality veiled in allegory and illustrated by symbols, which is defined officially as one of the world's oldest secular fraternal societies, a society of men concerned with spiritual values? Its members are taught its precepts by a series of ritual dramas which follow ancient forms and use stonemasons' customs and tools as allegorical guides. The essential qualification for admission and continuing membership is the belief in a supreme being, and membership is open to men of any race or religion who can fulfill this essential qualification and are of good repute. Perhaps the occultist who sees Freemasonry, the survival of ancient pagan mystery religions, sees something that, like beauty, is in the eye of the beholder. For what he sees is clearly invisible both to the governing body of the craft and to the bulk of its members. Freemasonry does have a traditional history around which its rituals are constructed that places its origin at the time of the building of King Solomon's Temple, but in the material world we can trace its history from 1717 AD when the first Grand Lodge in the world, the Grand Lodge of England, was founded at London. From that time on, Freemasonry has expanded, undergoing many vicissitudes along the way. Schisms, reconciliations, quarrels over jurisdiction, and quarrels over essential beliefs until today, it is firmly established in most countries in the world, the exceptions being countries of the communist bloc and those countries that suffer under strict religious fundamentalism. Regular Freemasonry, which, among other things, demands from its members a belief in God, forbids the discussion of religion and politics in its lodges and forbids also the admission of women to membership, is strongest in the English-speaking world, and it is a curious paradox that England, where the craft is most conservative, should have produced not only the foremost Masonic historians, but also the most adventurous and most widely read speculative interpretations of Masonic symbolism and philosophy. These latter have been invariably influenced by the Masonic tradition of continental Europe, where quote-unquote higher degrees and exotic rites have proliferated since the middle of the 18th century. At this point, it would be well to emphasize that all higher or additional degrees and grades are later inventions than the three craft degrees of the Entered Apprentice, Fellowcraft, and Master Mason, including the Supreme Order of the Holy Royal Arch, declared in 1813 by the United Grand Lodge of England to be the only degrees of pure ancient masonry, and further, that the governing bodies of the higher degrees have no control whatsoever over the craft degrees. The complex phenomenon of European Freemasonry was significantly different from its counterpart in the 18th century England. The essential Masonic tenets of tolerance and benevolence were overlain from an early date with layers of metaphysical speculation, while the simple craft rituals were extended into elaborate ceremonies for a multiplicity of degrees, grades, and orders, all of which involved extravagant, traditional histories and hierarchical ruling bodies that became increasingly divorced from reality. To some extent, such rites represented a way of escape from the political oppression of illiberal regimes and the spiritual oppression of the Roman Catholic Church, which had been implacably hostile toward Freemasonry from the beginning. But they inevitably drifted away from pure ancient Masonry to become either politicized or steered into overtly esoteric channels. Given their nature, it is scarcely surprising that it has been from these esoteric rites within and around Freemasonry, the Elu Cohens, the Strict Observance, the Illuminati, Cagliostro's Egyptian Masonry, and the 1001 self-styled Templar orders and chivalric degrees, rather than from craft Masonry, that occultists and esoterically inclined Freemasons alike have drawn, and continue to draw, their inspiration for orders of their own, and their plethora of false notions about the craft and its origins. It is unfortunate that there can be no authoritative official refutation of these false notions, but there can be no definitive pronouncement about the origins of Freemasonry for this simple reason that there is no certainty as to what those origins are. It is undeniable that Masonic ritual in its essentials is based upon the presumed customs and working tools of medieval stonemasons, but there is little to no evidence to support the popular theory of regular progression from operative Masonry to the speculative craft via a hypothetical transitional period during the 17th century, in which non-working members were gradually accepted into the Masonic lodges until they constituted a majority. A more provable theory of origin, but still, it must be stressed, only a theory, is that which suggests that Masonry arose during the 17th century from efforts of a group of enthusiasts who sought to establish tolerance in religion and the general improvement of society in an era which intolerance prevailed. They protected themselves by adopting the myth of the building of King Solomon's temple as an allegory of their aims and by utilizing the wholly appropriate structure of extant building guilds, an eminently sensible theory, but for occultists, wholly inadequate. There must be, for their purposes, both strictly esoteric content in Masonry and ultimately Gnostic source. Tolerance is too prosaic, and the medieval building guilds unsatisfactory by virtue of their unconformity to orthodox profession of Christian faith. Either the Knight Templar or the Rosicrucians or both offer more satisfying explanation of the emergence of Freemasonry in its speculative form, that there is no shred of historical evidence linking the Templars with Masonry, nor any certainty that the Rosicrucian as an organized body ever even existed, does not matter, since for occultists and for esoteric Freemasons, Freemasonry exists primarily to perpetuate the teachings of the ancient mystery schools, and there is thus necessarily a hidden connection between Freemasonry and its supposed forerunners. To the conclusive demonstration of such links, Masonic writers of esoteric inclination have devoted their literary careers only to have their work rejected as unsound by more prosaic Masonic scholars. Quote-unquote esoteric Masons, however, have been and still are mightily impressed by the apparent scholarship of authors such as the Reverend F.D.P. Castells, who considered that he had proved beyond doubt the link between the Rosicrucians and maintained that Freemasonry originated with certain Hebrew mystics associated with the Temple of Jerusalem, and that they are represented by the Kabbalists of historic times. The quote from Our Ancient Brethren, the Originators of Freemasonry, 1932, page 24. Castells wrote during the 1920s and 1930s, and although he was far from being the first Masonic historian on whom occultists had drawn, he was among the most impressive, for he united in his historical studies with the critical analysis of Masonic rituals and their symbolism, and it is Masonic symbolism that has proven always more irresistible to the occultists than even Masonic history. The rituals of the craft degrees represent the progress of the apprentice toward the mastery of the craft, illustrated by the building of the temple and accompanied by the inculcation of moral precepts, culminating in a symbolic reenactment of the death of the architect Hiram Abiff, who preferred to die rather than betray the secrets of his order. In the first degree, the three great lights, the volume of the sacred law, the square and compasses, and the three lesser lights, the sun, moon, and the master of the lodge, of Masonry, are explained to the candidate in symbolic form. While in each of the degrees, the appropriate working tools are similarly explained, the gavel, plumb, rule, level, etc., there is also an elaborate emblematic diagram or tracing board for each degree, the symbolism of which, variously architectural, biblical, and numerical, is explained in detail. While such a wealth of symbolism has a very specific meaning within Freemasonry, its very richness has left it vulnerable to the most wild and extravagant interpretations on the part of occultists and of esoteric Masons who ought to know better. Nor is the unreason of such interpretations lessened by the invariable insistence of the interpreters on seeing the third degree as the specific rite, and that rite includes a death and a resurrection, which it is not. It may suit the purposes of the occultist to see in it this light, but it is simply and solely a representation of the death of Hiram and his subsequent exhumation for decent reburial. Speculation on the meaning of Masonic symbols began in the 18th century, but serious attempts to relate those symbols to ancient resurrection myths and to the mainstream of the Western Hermetic tradition did not begin until the occult revival of the late 19th century. At the same time, amateur historians of occultism began to seek esoteric origins for Freemasonry itself. When these two paths of research merged, the results were curious indeed. H.P. Blavatsky, who was effectively the principal architect of the occult revival, had little interest in Freemasonry, but she utilized and believed much of the information amassed by Kenneth Mackenzie in his Royal Masonic Cyclopedia, 1877, and thus, through her own writing, acted as a channel for its dissemination throughout the theosophical world and far beyond the confines of Masonry itself. To what extent Mackenzie, who surprisingly did not accept that Freemasonry had roots in Rosicrucianism, believed his own statements is unclear, but he and his colleagues, F.G. Irwin, John Yarker, Dr. Woodman, and the rest, consciously attempted to emulate the 18th century proliferation of grandiose Masonic degrees and esoteric orders with considerable success, for it was from this background of exotic rites that William Wynne Westcott gained the inspiration for his immortal brainchild, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. That amazing creation, which came into being in 1888, owed its success in part to the increasing familiarity with Masonic symbolism via the works of Madame Blavatsky on the part of both male and female occultists. It is surprising enough that English Freemasonry should have given rose, however indirectly, to the androgynous order, that it should have provided the administrative structure, the framework of its rituals, and no small part of its eclectic symbolism is even more surprising, given that the proportion of English Freemasons interested in and informed about occultism was and is minute. Of those Freemasons who were inclined toward occultism at the close of the last century, the majority were deeply involved in the Theosophical Society, or at least in the teachings that it propagated. They absorbed it from the notion that the great antiquity of Eastern religions and superiority of Eastern philosophy over Western thought. From their subsequent mental confusion arose most of the books that have propagated original and bizarre ideas about the history and meaning of Freemasonry, but however reliable their histories may be, and however unsound their conclusions, their influence among fellow occultists has been so widespread and so pervasive that the students of the Hermetic tradition and its history cannot ignore them if he wishes to separate fact from fantasy and to understand how the present syncretistic structure of occultism has come about. During his lifetime, the most influential of these alternative Masonic historians was John Yarker, whose monumental work on the Arcane Schools, 1909, is really a prehistory of Freemasonry, which he saw progressing from the Egyptian and Greek mysteries via Mithraism, Gnosticism, and alchemy, with a brief conclusion on its history in modern times. Yarker controlled or influenced numerous quasi-Masonic rites, and through these, he effectively directed the thinking of many of his esoteric contemporaries, not least those who were members of the Co-Masonic Order, whose activities he supported while wisely refraining from joining. Universal Co-Masonry, which admits both men and women, was founded in France in 1893 and spread to England in 1902 by the way of the Theosophical Society, collecting Annie Besant and her coterie en route. Once Mrs. Besant was established in 1907 as president of the TS, her support, coupled with that of C.W. Ledbetter, led to a rapid expansion of co-masonry among theosophists, taking in even those who had previously been bitter opponents of Freemasonry. The order was, however, susceptible to the wider teachings of theosophy, as Ledbetter made clear in his utterly uncritical Glimpse of Masonic History, 1926. Quote, "With the advent of Dr. Annie Besant to the leadership of the order in the British Empire, the direct link between Masonry and the Great White Lodge, which has ever stood behind it, though all unknown to the majority of the brethren, was once again reopened." End quote. Page 328. Other occultists saw Freemasonry as deriving from sources not quite so far east. For Max Heindel, who was not a Freemason, it was rooted in hoary antiquity. Its very name was Egyptian, Freemason, or Children of Light, and the progress of the mystic Masonry would ultimately hasten, quote, the Second Advent of Christ, end quote. Freemasonry and Catholicism, 1931, page 86 and 98. This was admittedly an extreme interpretation. Esoteric Masons were generally more cautious in their imagings, although Manly Palmer Hall could claim that Masonry came to North Africa and Asia Minor from the lost continent of Atlantis, not under its present name, but rather under the general designation of the sun and fire worship. Secret Teachings of All Ages, 1936, page 176. He further maintained that, quote, "Within the Freemasonic mysteries lie hidden the long-lost arcana sought by all peoples since the genesis of human reason," end quote, page 176. And while this is strictly a personal opinion, Hall's arguments are presented as authoritative, and the influence of his books, which have remained continuously in print, has been so widespread among American occultists over the last 60 years that those who read nothing else on Masonry have tended to treat his opinions as facts. In England, other speculative Masons have been equally influential. J.S.M. Ward saw Masonic symbolism in the initiation rites of virtually every human culture, past and present, and Freemasonry was for him, quote-unquote, the survivor of the ancient mysteries. Nay, we may go further and call it the guardians of the mysteries. Freemasonry and the Ancient Gods, 1926, page 341, second edition. Ward's symbolist approach to Masonic history ought to have appealed to occultists, but they often are unaware of him, for his work has been confined almost exclusively to Masonic circles, unlike that of Dr. Westcott, for whom the reverse was true. As befitted the supreme magus, or head, of the Masonic Rosicrucian Society, Westcott believed firmly in the development of Freemasonry out of Rosicrucianism, and he argued forcefully that Masonic ritual was deeply tinged with Kabbalistic ideas, and yet for all the flaws in his scholarship, Westcott appreciated the value of historical research, and he thus rejected as unfounded the claims of Yarker, Ward, and others for a descent of Freemasonry from Mithraism or the Essenes. See Ars Coeritor Coronatum, Volumes 1, 28, 29. But while Westcott's purely occult works have remained popular, his Masonic writings are virtually unknown, and in attempting to bring Freemasonry to the notice of the occult world, he was less successful than his younger and more mystical contemporaries. W. L. Wilmshurst and A. E. Waite, both of whom wrote for a wider audience than purely Masonic ones, they presented their respective visions of Freemasonry as part of a more comprehensive and continuing spiritual tradition. And more importantly, the works of both men are still available, reaching and influencing an infinitely greater number of readers than either of the works of Westcott or those of their little-known critics who wrote to protest against their errors of fact. Waite especially was prone to treating historical data in a very cavalier manner. And this is the paradox of the hermetic misunderstanding of Freemasonry. The ideas of its motley crew of apologists are propagated in books that survive when the lives of their authors and their opponents are long forgotten, for there is a common thread that binds them together. Credulous oddities such as Heindel and Ledbetter, earnest if unsound scholars like Ward and Westcott, and such luminous mystics as Wilmshurst and Waite all shared a passionate conviction that Freemasonry holds a key, indeed the key, which will unlock the ancient mysteries, the secret tradition, or whatever one chooses to call that subtle alternative to the mundane history and orthodox thought. In the last analysis, that is what matters. It is of little consequence whether or not Freemasonry is descended from the mystery religions of antiquity. The important thing is that the influential figures in the recent history of the Hermetic tradition believed that it did, and this belief colored their perception of Hermeticism as a whole and determined manner in which they gave those perceptions practical expression. Without an appreciation of their idea of Freemasonry, however distorted and inaccurate it may have been, we cannot fully understand their role in the development of the Hermetic tradition in the modern era. Nor is this all. We must also be aware of the true nature of Freemasonry itself, of its relationship with the esoteric systems of thought during the period of its creation, and of the more esoteric theories of its origin. It may be that none of these theories is correct, that the occultists were right. After all, in assuming a vast antiquity for the craft, but even if it proves to have been nothing more than a curious social club, its presence, however passive, lay behind almost all of the esoteric orders of the last two centuries, orders whose creators believed in Freemasonry as the supreme vehicle for the transmission of a superior traditional wisdom. Unless we acknowledge the influence of the idea of Freemasonry and attempt to understand its nature, both as it is and as it was believed to be, our understanding of Hermeticism will be impoverished. We shall be like the candidate for Masonic initiation in a state of darkness. R.A. Gilbert is an antiquarian bookseller in Bristol, UK. He is the author of The Golden Dawn, Twilight of the Magicians, and A.E. Waite, Magician of Many Parts, and is currently working with John Hamill, the librarian of the United Grand Lodge of England, on a world history of Freemasonry. So there you have a really interesting... Now you may be thinking, why on earth did Robert read this piece? It flies in the face of a lot of what he tends to believe. It flies in the face of many of the listeners of the show's ideas about the origins of Freemasonry, etc., etc. Well, simply put, I have a duty to educate all of us, and sometimes that includes reading pieces that don't necessarily align with my viewpoint. But I did want to read this. I thought it was a fantastic article, and the claims, regardless of whether or not I agree with them, I feel were very good points. Of course, I couldn't help but notice his lack of critique on W.L. Wilmshurst, who is probably one of my favorite Masonic authors, and I think in my own way, while there are listeners out there who agreed with this paper, and there are those who don't, I will take one caveat here and say, even though I read something that maybe I don't agree with, I will offer one quote from W.L. Wilmshurst. And he says, "It is absurd to think that a vast organization like Masonry was ordained merely to teach grown-up men the world of the symbolical meaning of a few simple builder's tools." And that, of course, is from The Meaning of Masonry. Next up, I have a piece called The Old Charges by Wallace McLeod. Brother Wallace McLeod is a member and past master of Mitzvah Lodge No. 572, Toronto, Canada, and Kortor Coronati Lodge 2076, London, England, and is the Grand Historian of the Grand Lodge of Canada in the province of Ontario. The charges of a Freemason. In our Constitution, Ontario, in Section 371, we read the words, quote, "Every newly initiated candidate shall be presented with a copy of the Book of Constitution," end quote. One hopes that the new Mason will become familiar with our regulations by reading through this book, but if he does so, he may be puzzled by the first section of Part 6, which is entitled, quote, "The Charges of a Freemason Extracted from the Ancient Records of the Lodges Throughout the World for the Use of Lodges," end quote. In this section, he will find some parts that sound familiar, a bit like the ritual, quote, "The persons made Masons and admitted members of a lodge must be good and true men, freeborn, and of a mature and discreet age and sound judgment, no bondsmen, no women, no immoral or scandalous men, but of good report," end quote. But what is he to make of other portions? "The master, knowing himself to be able of cunning, shall undertake the Lord's work as reasonably as possible." Such rules as this cannot apply in any literal sense of most of us. Why then are they printed for every Mason? The reason is historical. In its present form, most of the wording of this section goes back 275 years. In 1723, the Reverend James Anderson, with the approval of his Grand Lodge, published the most influential work on Masonry ever printed, the first book of the Constitutions of the Freemasons. He included a section called The Charges of a Freemason, extracted from the ancient records of lodges beyond sea and of those in England, Scotland, and Ireland, for the use of the lodges in London. Apart from a number of tiny changes, the modern wording is identical. Anderson's sources. But here too we must ask the same question. Why did this book of constitutions designed for non-operative Masons include rules that apply to operative Masons? And where did Anderson find this material? The second edition of his constitutions, printed in 1738, tells a bit more, that at the annual festival on the 24th of June 1718, when the Grand Lodge was 1 year old, the Grand Master, quote, desired any brethren to bring to the Grand Lodge any old writings and records concerning Masons and Masonry in order to show the usages of ancient times. And this year, several old copies of Gothic constitutions were produced and collated. End quote. And in September 1721, the Grand Master and the Grand Lodge, finding fault with all the copies of the old Gothic constitutions, ordered Brother James Anderson to digest the same in a new and better method. The end result of his labors was the Book of Constitutions, which was duly approved by the Grand Lodge and printed in 1723, and James Anderson did make use of the old manuscripts that he called, quote, the old Gothic constitutions. We can tell from the wording of his text that by the time of his second edition, he had obtained access to at least six of them, and that he quoted and paraphrased them quite extensively. The old charges: number, date, location, form. But what are these old Gothic constitutions, also known as the old charges and the old manuscript constitutions? In all, 119 copies have survived, all going back to the same original, and there are references to 15 more that are lost. New versions are turning up all the time. In the last 10 years, 6 more have come to our attention. Nearly 2/3 of them are earlier than the first Grand Lodge of 1717, perhaps as many as 75. 55 go back to before 1700, 4 were written around 1600, and 1 is dated 1583. 1 is about 1400 or 1410, and 1 goes all the way back to 1390. Most are located in England. London alone has more than 50. 13 are in Scotland, none of them earlier than 1650. 4 are in the United States. 1 was last heard of in Germany, and 1 has wandered to Canada, the Scarborough manuscript of about 1700. The old charges present various aspects. About 14 are known only from printed transcripts. A few are written on separate sheets of paper or vellum. About 33 are written on sheets that are fastened together in a book form, but the typical form, represented by more than 50 versions, is a scroll or roll of paper or parchment between 3 and 14 inches wide, and anything up to 14.5 feet in length. Contents. Let us summarize the contents with a review and some typical examples of the wording. They nearly all begin with an invocation. Quote, "The might of the Father of Heaven, with the wisdom of the glorious Son, through the grace and goodness of the Holy Ghost, that be three persons in one Godhead, be with us at our beginning, and give us grace so to govern us here in our living, that we may come to his bliss that never shall have ending. Amen." End quote. Then comes an announcement of the purpose and contents, followed by a brief description of the 7 liberal arts and sciences, one of which is geometry or masonry. Then we have a proof of the fundamental nature of geometry. Then there is an extended traditional history of geometry, masonry, and architecture, taking up over half of the text. It is based in the first instance of the Bible. The art of building was invented, we are told, before Noah's flood by Jabal, and metal founding was discovered by his brother Tubal-Cain. They knew that God would send destruction for sin, so they wrote their arts on 2 great pillars that were found after the flood. Then we hear about Nimrod and the Tower of Babel, and how Abraham went to Egypt and taught the liberal arts and sciences to the Egyptians, and how he had a student, Euclid, and then how King David loved Masons well, how Solomon built the temple with the help of King Hiram and his master builder. One man who worked at Solomon's temple later went to France and taught the art to Charles Martel. Subsequently, the craft was brought to England in the time of St. Alban, and finally, about the year 930, Prince Edwin called Great Assembly of Masons in the city of York and established the regulations used, quote, "from that day until this time," end quote. Note, read this section as an ancient document, but remember the evolution of masonry is not historically accurate. Next, we have the manner of taking the oath. Quote, "Then let one of the elders hold the book, so that he or they may place their hands upon the book, and then the rules ought to be read," end quote. Then comes the admonition. Quote, "Every man that is a mason, take right good heed to these charges, If that you find yourself guilty in any of these, that you may amend you against God, and especially ye that are to be charged, take good heed that ye may keep these charges, for it is a great peril for a man to foresee himself upon the book." End quote. Next comes the regulations or charges proper. Some are to administer the trade. Quote, "No master shall take upon him no lord's work, nor no other man's work, but that he himself able and cunning to perform the same." End quote. These are the ones that are still quoted in the charges of a Freemason. Others do not concern trade matters at all, but are intended to regulate behavior. No doubt they were essential in the community of tradesmen who were thrown together in close proximity of 24 hours a day. Still, they are unexpected and serve to mark the Mason's Lodge as a different form, as different from most other craft organizations. No fellow is to slander another behind his back to make him lose his good name or his worldly goods, and also that no Mason shall play at hazard or at dice. Finally comes the oath. These charges that we have rehearsed, and all others that belong to Masonry, ye shall keep, so help you God and Hallidom, and by this book, to your power, amen. What were they used for? In its most common version, the text, about 3,500 words long, to copy it out by hand represents a substantial investment of effort, and yet it was copied repeatedly. In the circumstances, it is fair to ask what the old charges were used for. To begin with, the rules and orders serve a practical purpose. They clearly were intended to regulate the craft. We also know that occasionally the manuscripts were treated like a warrant or constitution. One early Scottish lodge had a copy of the old charges written on a single sheet of parchment, which had been mounted and framed, and the members believed that their meetings would not be legal unless it was exhibited in the lodge room. In a sense, the old charges also served as the work because they described certain procedures that were to be followed when any man was made a Mason. And they included a little bit of ritual, such as the invocation and the obligation. We see that they provided ordinance, authority, and ritual, three practical matters, but as well, they must have had a psychological effect. They inculcated in Masons a sense of response and reverence for their craft. They told how it went back before the flood, how it was connected with famous buildings and the sacred writings, and how it could number among its votaries even monarchs themselves. This was no servile trade of recent devising, but an ancient and honorable institution. Alright, I hope that gives you a little bit of history on the ancient charges and gives you some cool insights about those. Alright, and before we wrap this week, I did want to go ahead and give a shout out to West Alice Lodge, and I'm told I have to say thank you to Joseph Neubauer for not coming to the lecture and ruining the night. And that's actually from his brother Jacob, who was in attendance. Seriously though, West Alice Lodge was amazing, a great lodge building. If you're in the area, you got to stop by at one of their meetings and check out that lodge. The brothers there are fantastic, and Jacob will make you laugh for sure. So thank you so much, especially to Jacob, for putting this all together and having me out. It was absolutely wonderful. I hope to come up and visit again soon sometime. Last but not least, I want to mention how we support this program. So you can support this program any number of ways, but this is listener-supported education, so you all make this show possible. You are the producers. We've organized several things to make supporting this program beneficial to you also. So you can, of course, there are just direct donations. You can make a donation to the show, whether that's $5 or 5 cents, it doesn't really matter. It all goes back to supporting this show. You can also become a monthly contributor, a fellow, or a producer. Check out the links on our website, wcypodcast.com. Hover over Support the Show and click on Make a Donation. Additionally, we also have a limited edition shop where you can pick up our lapel pin, which is exclusive. We have a few money clips left. We are sold out of tie bars. We're sold out of cufflinks. We still have some Mason Lady stickers for your lady's car if they're interested in that. And I'll be working on something new, hopefully, to present to help fund this show. We are really low on lapel pins, and those probably are not going to be produced again. So those of you who have them, enjoy them. There was a very limited run. We ran them a few times. There were 625 lapel pins made, and they are almost all gone. And we've gone through those in the last couple of years. So if you have one, good for you. If you do not, then we have a few left. You should probably go to the website and get one if you're interested. And we've worked out a few affiliates, some great partnerships now. And these are from, first and foremost, Bankers Best. Bankers Best is a wonderful company owned by a brother, Brother Levi Banker, who's come up with a few great products that are exclusively Masonic in nature, and he actually donates 50% of the profits of these products to the show. But he also has a whole line of amazing products. Mostly, it's all beard and skincare. I would definitely recommend these guys. You can go direct to his website, buybankersbest.com, or again, you can go right to our website and hover over Support the Show and click on Bankers Best. That's wcypodcast.com. Or go right to buybankersbest.com. You're going to want to use the promo code BBWCY357 at checkout, and that's how you get a little percentage off. We have the Great Books program, which is starting again in August. Please head on over there to check out the details on that. And Onnit Labs, if you're interested in Alpha Brain. Alpha Brain includes, it's just a pill that you take, a couple pills. It's not like multiple pills a day or anything. It's two pills a day. The benefits include increased focus. It's all natural, so there's not even dyes in the capsules. It's vegan approved, promotes lucid dreaming, heightened awareness, and all this without any caffeine. So check that stuff out. It's awesome. It's one of my favorites. If you use the coupon code WCY, you'll get 10% off as well. And the very last thing I'll mention is the book, It's Business Time, Adapting a Corporate Path for Freemasonry. This is a book that I co-wrote with Brother John T. Ruark. And essentially what we have done is we have offered a book that has logistical assistance on the operational lodge and its officers. What we did was we took the best practices that have worked for business over the last 100 years, and we have adapted those to work for Freemasonry. It's a concise guide. We've got a 4.5-star review. It was number one in its category on several things, but you can get it in paperback, and we also have it in Kindle. You can check that out right in Amazon.com. If you type in It's Business Time Freemasonry, you'll find it, or you can head on over to WCYPodcast.com, and in the right sidebar there, you'll see links for both the Kindle and the print copy. So that's it for this week, everybody. I hope you enjoyed. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you all next week. Again, happy Father's Day if you're listening to this on Sunday. Likely, it's Monday morning. And in that case, I hope you had a great Father's Day. Take care. Until next week, stay in the love. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.